This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. The Consumer Electronics Show wraps up this weekend in Las Vegas. That's where some of the world's coolest gadgets have made their debut over the years. Remember Pong on Atari? That was unveiled at CES in 1975, and we've come a long way since then. 3D television, tablet computers, cars we can talk to. NPR's Laura Seidel was at the show in Las Vegas, and she joins us to fill us in on the exciting products from this year's show. Welcome, Laura.
Nice to be here.
Does that sound of Pong take you back?
I'm not old enough to remember. I'm just kidding.
Stop. But I'll tell you what I'm not ready for is 3D television.
Yes, yep. 3D televisions. They're there and the glasses along with them. And there were a lot of them this year at CES. Everybody's putting out a 3D television. And of course, there is content that's coming out for 3D. Sony, Discovery, and IMAX have teamed up. They're going to create a channel with just 3D content. ESPN is going to put out about 85 games starting this year in June. They're going to start with the World Cup and they're going to have that in 3D. And there were lots of TVs to watch them on. And it was pretty lovely stuff, I have to say.
Really? You liked it? It worked for you?
It does work in a certain way. Although I have to admit, I walked by a poster promoting it and you saw these families all sitting around with their 3D glasses, and it looked odd.
Like those old photos from the magazines of the 50s, right?
Yeah, it just looked odd. You know, somebody joked, you know, 3D is the technology of the future and it always will be. You know, we've been talking about it a long time, really, since Pong, right?
Really?
You know, think about how long we've been talking about 3D, but the technology has come a long way. The entire industry is behind it. They're pushing it. Now, I have to say, as to whether or not it's going to happen as fast as they think it is, I'm skeptical.
Computers, Sony and HP, others unveiled their version of something called the tablet, not a phone, not a laptop. What is it?
Okay, briefest description would probably be it's a laptop without a keyboard. With the latest versions or some of the versions I've seen, you can use a stylus like a pen, so you could actually write into it. You can carry your movies, your books. And I want to say, even though there were a lot of e-book readers on the floor, I think what we're really evolving to eventually is tablet computers. So the e-book is a transition phase.
How soon will we see that?
Well, we're going to start seeing them very soon. But here's the big news that was looming over CES. The end of the month, Apple is expected to announce a tablet computer. There are a lot of rumors about it. I believe when there's this many rumors that Apple's going to do something, it's usually true. And everybody's waiting to see because Apple has this tendency to really push everything forward and create these beautiful devices. I mean, think about the iPod and the iPhone, right?
Speaking of an iPhone, was there really a helicopter drone that one company's making and it can be remote controlled using an iPhone?
Yes! It's made by this French company called Parrot, and you can control it with an iPhone, and it kind of floats and hovers. And I think the idea is that you might be able to develop games for it. So, you know, kind of games that would be both computerized games and real-world games. Go searching for clues with your own personal drone.
Wow. Lots of announcements about getting internet in cars, voice-activated systems. Can I ask you about Magic Jack 2.0? This is a device, a little gadget. It's going to sell.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean,
yes.
Actually, it's something that the cell carriers are protesting because it's using radio waves without permission, right?
Yes, that's right. Well, Magic Jack's been out, and there's been about 5 million people who've purchased the previous Magic Jack, which basically lets you make internet phone calls on your computer. What the key here is that this one will actually, if you have your cell phone in the house, it will connect to your cell phone and you'll be able to make free cell phone calls. That would actually use the radio waves that these carriers have spent a lot of money to buy. And so that is why they're protesting. The people who make it say, well, you don't own the waves that are actually in somebody's house, and this is just for making free cell phone calls in the house, but it could save people a lot of money. These tech battles sometimes over who owns the airwaves can go on for a long time.
Finally, did you see the Google phone?
Yes, I have, and I liked it. People keep asking, is it an iPhone killer? I don't know if it's an iPhone killer, but it moves quickly. I found the battery life to be longer than the iPhone, and I definitely found it to be something that was comparable to an iPhone. I really liked using it.
And the Google phone is called the Nexus One?
That is correct.
NPR's Laura Seidel was at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas this past week. Laura, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Before Nintendo Wiis and Sony PlayStations, there were pinball machines. Pinball may be history for today's generation of gamers, but it's a history that David Silverman wants to preserve. In the past 30 years, Silverman has collected 867 pinball machines, from 1920s flat box games designed to be played on bar tables to today's freestanding computerized games with music and sound effects. One day, he hopes to open a national pinball museum where his prized possessions will be on display. For now, they reside in a building he constructed behind his house in Silver Spring, Maryland. Silverman works as a landscaper, specializing in Japanese gardens. But he found the time this past week to show us his collection of pinball machines and explain how his passion for pinball began.
I immediately was attracted by the color and the artwork. And as a four-year-old, I mean, I was just fascinated with it. And my father gave me a bunch of nickels. From that point on, as they say, you know, history in the making.
Take us to a game of that era.
Oh.
When you were four.
Yes, okay.
See if we can squeeze by these. The slick chick.
Yeah, this game. Coronation would be a game of my era. Now, realistically, I would say I'm an average player. Not above average, and I think probably when I was a young kid, I was a better player than I am now, and most of the people I know who are older players feel the same way.
Look at you, racking up.
I got a million. And to get a free game, you have to get 5,200,000, and all I have is 2 million, so I'm a kind of a pathetic player.
Now, we happen to be backed into another game, which appears much, much older.
How old
is this game?
This game's about 1929.
Right. So there's no flippers.
No flippers.
What there are there these silver balls, and you put some nickels up here. Does that mean I can put it in?
Absolutely.
All my balls come out.
Now you shoot it.
Okay. Do you want me to shoot it?
Oh, yeah, you got 2 balls in one time.
All right, let's see what I got. Missed. Yeah, that's where they all end up. Did you restore this game?
Yes. Yeah.
And that's what you do as well. You restore games, you collect games,
display games.
You let people come in and play games.
Yes.
And your ultimate goal is to actually have a pinball museum.
What I'm trying to do is save American history, because these pinball machines go along the lines of history. The game you looked at before coronation was when Queen Elizabeth was coronated.
Really?
So this was...
Pinball was made in honor of...
Exactly. And so many of the games that you see here have a lot to do with what was happening at the time. The artwork is similar as well.
I have to stop you, though, but Queen Elizabeth, I've never seen her in a bikini wearing a fuchsia cape with those little platform ankle shoes that they wore in 1950, blonde hair, something like, you know, Betty Grable or...
Well, you have to remember that pinball was a man's game. A lot of the pinball machine, the height of pinball was after World War II. So the soldiers coming home who were used to pin up girls in their lockers, basically all the artwork, what we call the back glass, was to attract the player. And what was on them? Mostly women.
You're actually standing in front of Coronation.
Correct.
But it is flanked by
Sweet Adeline.
Roto Pool is next to Coronation. Nine Sisters is next to it. And Green Pastures is next to that one. These seem to be a heyday of pinball. But they were always in these dark, kind of nefarious places. When did pinball become kind of a social no-no?
That was actually pretty early. The company called Bally invented a payout game. And once these games were invented, that was gambling. So pinball was outlawed in the three major cities that were important for pinball. That was New York City, that was Chicago, and that was L.A. But not until 1976 did they finally legalize pinball in New York City.
Okay, so it's, you know, the middle of a Sunday afternoon, and you've got the urge to play some pinball, and you say, I'm going to go down to my museum, such as it is at this point, and I want to play a game. What game do you choose to play?
Well, there's a game right next to you called Big Bang Bar. That is my favorite game.
All right, come on over. Let's take a look at this thing.
The black light will come on. And it changes the color. All of the greens, all of the colors, especially when the room is dark, which is what I like to play pinball in.
Now, this has things modern that I recognize. The little tracks where balls go, the ramps, the kind of in and out and down and above. I mean, this is really bells and whistles.
And that this is called the attract mode. This is quite innovative because watch, it'll tell you the story.
On the night of July 2nd, 1947, a loud crash was heard near Roswell, New Mexico. Remains of an alien spacecraft were recovered, although this was officially denied by the United States government. Was this craft an advanced scout of an impending alien invasion of Earth, or was it simply an accident by a group of joyriders having one too many?
At the Big Bang Bar.
At the Big Bang Bar.
Anybody who comes in here who looks reputable can play the games for nothing.
All right, how do I look?
You look pretty reputable.
All right, I think I'm going to play this game.
Press that button.
Like I'm going to get that far.
Player one, Ray wants to see you at the bar.
Ray wants to see you at the bar. Well, where's Ray?
Oh, Ray's up there.
All right.
You have 13 million so far.
Player
all right.
One, I need to see some ID.
Hey, I'm old enough. Come on.
Top stands.
Ah!
Well, watch what happens when the game's over.
If you win it, I see.
Watch. What happens when you're in a bar?
And drink too much?
You throw up.
David Silverman, thank you for showing us your collection of pinball machines, and good luck with the Pinball Museum.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Would you mind if I played Adam's Family?
Of course.
Good shot.
Ah! Where did that come from? That's not fair.
This is NPR's Weekend Edition, directed by Ned Wharton and produced by Kimberly Adams, Sarah Beyer Kelly, Peter Breslow, Elaine Heinzman, Veronica Miller, Thomas Pierce, Gemma Waters, and Habiba Noshin. Our technical director is Burke Hun. Our librarian is Kim Oleski. Melissa Goh is our web producer. Our show was produced today by Walter Ray Watson. Our senior editor is Tony Marcano. The senior producer of Weekend Edition is Devar Iran Ardalan. And on a bittersweet note, we say goodbye today to producer Charla Bear. It will be impossible for us to calculate our loss. In the past year alone, Charla has produced and reported pieces from a Washington, D.C. high school to Los Angeles farmers market to the extreme southern tip of Argentina. We've had the good fortune of benefiting from her amazing work and professionalism. And we've had the distinct pleasure of her collegial company and good cheer. Our loss is public radio's gain. Charla is moving to Seattle to report for member station KPLU. So send us your best work, Charla. Happy birthday, and remember, keep your thumbs up while dancing. I'm Leanne Hansen. While Americans start to whisper in hopeful tones about economic recovery, some states continue to register a disturbing sign of hard times. Bodies are being left unclaimed at local morgues. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, April Baer has the story.
To step into the morgue at the Oregon Medical Examiner's Office is to confront destitution at its most final. In this frigid, dark locker, the dead lie draped in plastic sheeting on steel tables. These aren't folks who died watched over by family. Dr. Karin Gunson's morgue is the first stop for people who were killed in car accidents or shootings, or who simply died at home by themselves.
Many times, if they happen to end up at the medical examiner's office,
they have made some choices in their life where they're no longer very close to their family. It might be drugs or alcohol or just a wanderlust. It's extremely rare where we don't find someone.
Gunson says these people died unexpectedly, and their families, if they had families, weren't prepared. Oregon's one of several states that provides funding for so-called indigent burials. Historically, this money does a final service for people with no home or relatives. But in 2009, Gunson says an unprecedented number of bodies went unclaimed, some for a month or more, not because family couldn't be found, but because the economy has left families unable to pay for even the most basic $500 cremation.
We don't really want to become a storage place.
The trend is elusive to track. In Oregon, demand on the Indigent Burial Fund was so high last year, the legislature had to nearly triple fees on death certificates to keep the fund solvent. Illinois received so many requests for burial help that its funds were temporarily shut down over the summer. And in Michigan, where the economy hemorrhaged 300,000 jobs last year, indigent burials nearly doubled from 603 in 2008 to over 1,100. Oregon has avoided overcrowding in its morgues with an arrangement that sends unclaimed remains to funeral homes, who then solicit families for at least partial payment. That's when the real negotiating over final arrangements begins.
My mom called me and she's like, you might want to call them because nothing's been done and this is what's going to happen if nobody pays.
Last October, Rosemary Goldsworthy was still reeling from the shock of her father's death when the mortuary began phoning asking for payment or else.
You know, he'll just get buried in a grave with a bunch of strangers who also aren't claimed and some county cemetery.
Goldsworthy and her fiancé live in a town with 14% unemployment. They're barely getting by on his part-time pay at a furniture factory. While she negotiated a rare payment plan for her father's burial, family members told her they wouldn't be able to help with the $340 down payment. This kind of bruising discussion, funeral directors say, is not uncommon these days. After months of negotiation, the mortuary finally agreed to release her father's ashes for a nominal fee. Goldsworthy says she thought constantly about what might become of his cremated remains and where they'd end up.
I want some of him. I want to have a part of my dad.
But what about families who can't pay, won't pay, or can't be found? Aaron Phelps is the owner of Omega Funeral and Cremation Services in Portland.
Down here we are, the cremated remains that are unclaimed. We keep them in this storage utility area.
In an unfinished corner of his mortuary's attic, rows and rows of plain white boxes stand, neatly stacked, each one bearing the name of someone left unclaimed. Some 60 people have come to rest here over 16 years. Phelps says there's no doubt many surviving families are having real trouble meeting burial expenses. But he's also noticed more people finding reasons not to pay to bury the family's black sheep, expecting the Indigent Burial Fund to step in.
The thing I find the hardest to take is when there are people who have the resources and simply will not do anything.
So once every few months, when Phelps has a paid service scheduled at the Oregon coast, his staff will take along the remains for cases that he considers closed after years of research. The ashes of the unclaimed will be trucked out to the ocean and scattered in the waters of Tillamook Bay. For NPR News, I'm April Baer in Portland, Oregon.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
From eclipsing stars now to a computer program that could make sports writers disappear. It's the product of the Intelligent Information Laboratory at Northwestern University, and it's called StatsMonkey. What it does is take the statistics from a baseball game and produce a computer-generated news story about that game.
University Park, an outstanding effort by Willie Argo, carried the Illini to an 11-5 victory over the Nittany Lions on Saturday at Medlar Field. Argo blasted two home runs.
That's Chris Hammond. He's co-director of the lab at Northwestern, and he's reading a story generated by the StatsMonkey program. And I have to say, Chris Hammond, that sounds pretty close to what you might read in the local paper.
It's, I mean, that's what it's aimed at being.
So how does it work? How does the program work?
Well, it starts with the numbers. And in fact, in general, what we do is we go from numbers to story. So it looks at the box scores, it looks at the play-by-play information, and then it uses that to figure out what we call the angle. That is, what kind of game was this? Was it a back and forth? Was it a pitcher's duel? And then from that, it actually generates the language.
What if something sort of a bit unusual happens? You know, say a pitcher throws a no-hitter, or, you know, a bat slips out of a hitter's hands and injures a fan. Can the program actually handle those scenarios?
Yes and no. For a no-hitter, absolutely. For a bat slipping, no, because that's not going to be reflected in the numbers.
Why? I mean, you work at Northwestern, at the journalism school at Northwestern. Why would a journalism school sort of be interested in creating a computer program that could eventually make what you do and the people you train irrelevant?
That's a good question. It doesn't make anybody irrelevant. We're really aiming this at a genuinely local audience. That is, we're trying to write the stories that no one else is writing. We could literally write a game story for every single Little League game that's played in this country. And that means every kid, every dad, every family, every grandma would see the story of what their kid is doing.
At some point, you're going to lose control over that technology. And so I'm wondering if you don't see it as a technology that will replace human beings as journalists.
Yes, someday we'll build something that can do absolutely everything a journalist can do, given that they, you know, the facts are in front of them. But that's our goal. Our goal is to genuinely model human thought, intelligence, reasoning. But always looking to the long tail, looking to the places that are underrepresented, underreported, and trying to fill that niche.
What about sports writers? Have any of them contacted you and said, you know,
Not cease and desist.
Oh.
We actually had a writer who did a side-by-side of his story and our story. He said, I hope you guys don't try to replace me because I like going to games. And it would make me sad if that was no longer part of my job. And honest to God, we have no interest in doing that.
So no chance of, you know, I'll be replaced by a computer anytime soon?
In a couple weeks. No, not anytime soon.
Chris Hammond is co-director of the Intelligent Information Laboratory at Northwestern University. He joined us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Chris Hammond, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.